Do you know your CFP from the CIA? Do you know what a fiduciary is? We will answer those questions and more today on the Teach and Retire Rich podcast as Scott and I look at working with an advisor. Today's topic, working with an advisor, was suggested by a listener named Michael, who is a retired veterinarian from the state of Washington. Michael has been helping his sister with her 403B at the hospital she works at. Michael was curious about the various advisor designations. I thought we would look at that, in addition to how advisors are compensated, what they do, and what questions to ask when interviewing prospective advisors. How does that sound, Scott?
Sounds great. Yeah, it's not as easy as it sounds. And just getting a referral from somebody is not really the best way to go because most people haven't actually vetted the advisor they're working with. In fact, most people aren't even working with someone who is technically an advisor. That term itself is a bit loaded and misused quite a bit.
Yeah, I think I run into teachers all the time and they talk about their advisor. And if you start digging a little deeper, these generally are salespeople. And so this term has just been used so loosely. So Scott, I actually was speaking to an advisor yesterday and he said, yeah, I've been following your stuff for a while and I know you're not supportive of advisors. And I said, no. Wow, I'm sorry for that misconception. We actually are very supportive advisors. One of my best friends is an advisor. We do a podcast.
You're not an advisor phobe.
Yeah, exactly. I think personally advisors are unbelievably useful. You've been so helpful with you know, my family's finances. The problem has been, especially in the K-12 arena, that people, as we alluded to, are masquerading as advisors and they're really just salespeople. And I think they've given the whole profession a terrible name and reputation. So yes, we are very supportive of the right kind of advisor. And, you know, sort of piggybacking off this idea of people really loosely using the term advisor, I went on to the FINRA website, and this is the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. Scott, you probably know this, but I wonder if our audience does. This organization lists more than 150 professional designations. React.
Wow. I mean, that's insane. And we use the term, or they use the term, professional designation. But I'm willing to bet the vast majority of these designations are neither professional nor real designations. It's kind of like the term natural. There's no regulation of it, and you can call anything natural, and people, oh, well, it's natural. So it must be good for me. Designation really has no connotation these days because there's so many designations that proliferate.
Yeah, and this is one of our biggest criticisms of the financial industry as a whole. It's the complexity, the needless complexity, which I think sows seeds of confusion, and it leads many people to then turn to people that end up being more salespeople than actual true professionals. So what I thought we would do is, obviously we're not going to go through the 150. Let's go through a couple of the main ones, the designations that we think our audience, which again would be K-12 teachers, higher ed people, healthcare professionals. Really, I would say for this topic, it could be anyone interested in getting some help with their finances. So, Scott, what would be the main designations? This is the credentialing that someone should look for if they're considering working with a true financial professional.
Well, I think So first of all, you should be looking at not just the designation, but the overall competence of the person. Believe it or not, there are some people who don't have any designations, but are actually really good. They've got a lot of experience in the marketplace, and they know what they're doing. But designations do help in determining whether, what type of coursework they've done. So I think you have to look behind the designation, though, to really truly understand if it has any meaning at all. I think designations are a good thing, and because there are some very legit designations, it has caused, an entire industry to crop up around creating designations that look like they are professional in nature, when in reality they're just, I mean, you can get some of these in just a couple hours. You just go sit in a class. Sometimes you just have to pay a fee to get them. So with you really have to look behind a designation and see what it is that a person has to go through to get it. But then behind the designation, you also need to like take a look at their overall body of work. Do they have a degree? For example, I have a bachelor's degree in finance. That's not to say someone who doesn't have a bachelor's degree in finance or business or something like that shouldn't be considered. But I have a degree in finance. I have a master's degree in financial planning. And I also hold the certified financial planner designation. But when looking at a designation, you should take a look at what does it take to get this designation? How many hours do they need to spend on average studying, and where do they study, and who is the credentialing body? There are several designations out there who just credential themselves, which means absolutely nothing. So what is the body of work someone has to go through in order to get this designation? Is there a test? How is that test administered? Is it self-study? I mean, is it open book? Is it proctored? How difficult are the questions? If you were to take many of these designations exams, they're very short. You can do them in less than an hour, and they're open book. So, I mean, what has a person really done by getting that designation? It's purely to put on their business card to look like they've done something, when in reality they haven't. And it's, to me, it's a slap in the face, because the CFP is not a simple designation to get. I had to spend a lot of time to get that. And I'm not saying that just because, we'll get into what a CFP is in a little bit. I'm not saying just because someone has a CFP, it means that they are competent and they know what they're doing, but it does represent, in my opinion, the minimum standard in the industry, the Certified Financial Planner designation. But, you need to look behind it. What's the education requirements? What's the experience requirements? What's the examination requirements? And finally, what are the ethical requirements of holding that designation? And is there a body that oversees those requirements and enforces them? If not, it's just an adornment for a business card to increase sales.
So, Scott, we watch Better Call Saul.
Yes.
Do you know where Mr. Goodman got his law degree?
Was it like at an online university or
It
something? I
was
don't remember.
the University of American Samoa. Go Sand Crabs. So basically, you don't want a planner who got his or her degree from that institution, probably.
Yeah, I probably not. That's probably not the best place to get. Although, I haven't really,
That's true.
I haven't looked into it enough. Maybe they have a really tough curriculum. Maybe a lot of sipping of margaritas. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, no, in all seriousness, you raise a lot of good points, and we'll get into CFP details here in a moment. But as far as questions go, questions to ask any potential planner you might hire, we've compiled, Scott, you helped me put this together, a list of questions. We call it the Advisor Questionnaire, and you can download that from our homepage from 403bwise.com, sort of the upper right there. You can just sort of in the middle of the upper right of the homepage, just go ahead and click that, download that. There's about 20 questions that you can ask. So, Scott, you said something pretty interesting. You said the CFP, Certified Financial Planner designation, is a minimum designation that that someone should look for when they are exploring working with a planner? Is that what you said?
That's my opinion. That's what I think should be the minimum standard around the globe. Prior to, well, there were several designations that have been available for true financial planners. And over the years, some of those have kind of combined and coalesced. But for the most part, CFP has been the one that has really gained acceptance, especially here in the US. I guess I should have looked at the numbers before I jumped on, but I think there's now upwards of 70,000 people who have gotten their CFP over the years. And it really has become the designation to have, but it's not the end all. I mean, that's not where I think people should stop their education. I think it's really becoming the minimum requirement to be a true financial planner in this day and age. And it's not to say there's not other designations that might be close or equivalent. There's another one called the CHFC that actually has more coursework than the CFP, but it doesn't have the exam requirement. So I really think the CFP is really the minimum standard. If you want to be a financial planner in this business and you want to be here long term, pursuing the CFP demonstrates that you are committed to this industry and at least to a minimum body of knowledge, and that you will commit to a certain continuing education and ethics requirement, which in my opinion is good. I think the standards that they have set up really are good. And one caveat to that is the CFP standards have changed over time. So like 30 years ago, taking the CFP is very different than maybe getting the CFP these days. There are very different requirements. They've increased the requirements. They've made it more difficult to get. Although I did hear a few months ago that they might be making the test a little bit easier. So we'll see. But I can tell you, it was not an easy test when I took it. I didn't think I had passed it actually when I took it.
It's multiple days.
It was 2 days. It was 2 5-hour days. I'm not exactly sure how they do it nowadays, but it was 2 5-hour days, proctored exam, and it was so up to it, you can take up to 10 hours. I think I completed mine in maybe 5 or 6, which was part of the reason I thought I failed it. I thought I just went through this too fast. I bet you I did not do well. But I did well. I passed it, so very happy about that. If I had to do it again today, oh man, it'd be tough.
Yeah, I concur. Well, what about the term broker? What does that mean? One of my students once said they're the people that make you go broke.
Now, a broker is really just a middleman. It's not like we said in our last podcast, annuities aren't good or bad. It just depends on how they're used and in what situations. Brokers are the same way. You have real estate brokers, you have mutual fund brokers, you have stock brokers, and in the right, I mean, Charles Schwab and TD Ameritrade and Fidelity, they're all brokers. And if you buy or sell stocks through them, there's nothing wrong with that. You need someone to execute a transaction to be in the middle. That's all they really are. Brokers, in terms of being financial planners, they're not financial planners. And it's really becoming an obsolete term. Anybody who wants to be successful in this business, the business of financial planning and even investment management, is unlikely to call themselves a broker because there is a negative connotation. And it is kind of brings up this whole salesperson type thing. They're selling a stock or they're acting as a middleman, and people want to get the middleman out of the way. So broker is really a term that I think is going to go away.
I don't know if I ever told you this story, Scott, but back in the height of the dot-com mania, I had an opportunity to buy initial public offering shares of the company Buy.com. Did I tell you about that?
No.
Yeah, my friend was part of this startup. It was based in Orange County, Buy.com. They were in competition with Amazon, and we kind of know how that all shook out, but at the time it was pretty exciting because these type of companies were going public every day, and invariably by the end of the close, they had, doubled in value, tripled in value. And a good friend of mine who I went to college with and still a very good friend got me in on the friends and family initial offering. And I got invested $5,000. My money doubled by the end of the day. And I felt like a genius, And Scott, I will tell you, for the next 2 months, I got calls almost every day from Merrill Lynch brokers trying to get me into all kinds of internet stocks, mutual funds, initial public offerings. Anyway, I said no to all of that stuff. So I'm pretty sure those were brokers. But just on a side note, my dad told me just to sell immediately. So I sold the next day and I doubled
Wow.
My take to $10,000, and of course had taxes and all that kind of stuff. And several of my other friends who got in on this, they wrote it down to $0 because they thought it could be the next huge thing and it could, quadruple. But that was definitely a case where I was reluctant. I mean, I got into, what do they say? The market is, it's the balance between greed and fear. And I was jumped right into that greed, and it was intoxicating, Scott, to be part of something like that.
Oh yeah, I bet. And we're starting to see, or well, last year and the year before, we saw a lot of that happen again in the tech stocks that were coming public. And I remember Buy.com, it made some people millionaires for a little while before it made them poor again. And I had it, so I was working at Merrill Lynch during that time. So maybe I was
Hey,
one
did you
of the,
call me?
I know, like, gosh, now it's starting to sound familiar. I think I was pushing like a online gift card marketplace. Okay, but I put up a sign. It made the brokers there at Merrill Lynch so mad because I was only a sales assistant, so I was just the guy who did all the work for the brokers at this point in time. And I put up a sign behind my desk. It was a quote, I believe, from John Maynard Keynes, and the quote was, "Don't confuse brains with a bull market." And this is during the tech boom. It just pissed people off because they just thought they were these geniuses. And the true genius here was you. You sold. You were the one who was smart enough to sell.
I credit my dad.
Yeah, I had a client who was in a company that he'd been given a whole bunch of shares, and he wanted to know what to do with it. They had gone up a lot. I mean, we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars it was worth. And this was in 2000. Right as everything was getting really volatile, and we were looking at it, and he wanted to know what the tax consequences were to sell. We went through them, and I'm like, "Man, you are going to pay a ton of taxes if you sell this. I mean, it's going to be ugly." And so maybe we should think about not selling. But I went home that night, and the more I thought about it, I'm like, "There's no way this company is worth this. I mean, this is insane. This is a lottery ticket." And if he lets the taxes wag this dog, it's going to be a dog with fleas very soon. And so the next day I called him up and said, "Listen, man, I don't care what the taxes are. Sell it and sell it now. All of it." Client sells. And this was not like a call that the market was going to crash. It's an individual stock. So he sells. Stock goes up 20 points from like 160 to 180, And I'm like, "Oh, it was still good advice, still good advice." 45 days later, the stock was at $2, fallen 98%. And I am his hero to this day.
Yeah, I wonder if you have to be have someone test your food, make sure your car starts and doesn't explode. I mean, I can only imagine the frustration and anger initially that this client probably had towards you.
Well, I told him, I go, "Listen, man, the way stocks are going, this thing could continue to go up, but you should just forget about it and, take your. You had none of this a year ago, and now you've got like a $500,000. Just be thankful that you have it." And, I'm not sure how we got onto this from advisor
It's my
to,
fault.
but
I
we
jumped
were
in.
brokers.
We were talking about brokers, and I'll close out, and we'll get on to the topic at hand to get back to the topic at hand. But I really feel for my friend Keith because he worked for the company. He was unable to sell shares for I think 6 months. There's like a window where before they can start selling,
Yeah.
and by the time he was eligible to sell, it had declined pretty drastically. So
It's called a lockup period, and yeah, it's can work for you and against you.
I can only imagine how you would feel mentally, like being a sort of a paper millionaire and just waiting for this date in the future. Meanwhile, you're hearing the crash of the market, just the slow, then sudden. But
Well,
anyway.
it was almost impossible to hedge those positions at that point in time because they were so new. It's not like you could have created some sort of hedge. Well, I mean, you could have, but it would have been very difficult and would have required a lot of foresight. But yeah, it is sad.
Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. So hopefully we didn't lose our audience there, but back to the financial designations of planners. Scott, what is an RIA? I hear that a lot. RIA.
Oh, yeah, a lot of people think an RIA is actually a designation. It's not a designation, and it's actually not allowed to be used on your business card, like comma RIA, like you would normally see somebody's name followed by RIA. RIA is a business structure. It stands for Registered Investment Advisor, and it's you would an advisor like myself creates an RIA, goes through the regulatory process, usually with the SEC or with the state. And it's really just a legal structure that allows you to give advice for a fee according to certain guidelines that have been set up through the Investment Advisory Act, I believe, of 1935, something like that. So an RIA is really just a legal structure to provide financial advice.
Okay.
It's not a designation. It's easy to set up. Very few minimum requirements. So just because someone has RIA doesn't mean that they're competent.
And as you alluded to earlier, you can have good RIAs and poor RIAs, I'm guessing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So before we move on to the term fiduciary, which we are big proponents of, are there any other designations you would like to discuss, or should people really just focus on the CFP? And if this person is not a CFP, then they need to move on. And we'll also, in this podcast, give some resources for finding CFPs.
Well, I don't want to give such a hard and fast rule, but I think someone should be, they definitely need to do more analysis if they don't have a CFP than if they do. Even if someone does have a CFP, that's not enough. They shouldn't just look at someone who has a CFP and says, "Oh, okay, well then they must be good." I've seen a lot of CFPs who are, I would not want my family to work with. Being a CFP does not mean that you have a specific investment philosophy. It doesn't mean you have anything in common with anybody else, other than that you have completed a body of knowledge or a body of work, taken a test, passed it, have an experience requirement. But everybody has different investment philosophies. Everybody has different financial planning philosophies. And you could be a CFP who just sells variable annuities for commissions all day. And that so you have to dig a little deeper. Be asking if they're a fiduciary is something big. But in terms of the designations that people should pay attention to, for a financial planner, I do think the Certified Financial Planner designation or CFP is a good minimum standard to start with. Other designations people might hear are and ones that I think are legit would be the CFA. This is the Chartered Financial Analyst. This is really not as applicable to people who are working with a financial planner. People who get the CFA more likely to be in portfolio management, more likely to work for a money management firm. Sometimes you'll see CFAs working for RIAs in a capacity of asset allocation and things like that. It's a very, very tough designation to get, probably among the toughest out there. It's very tough, very rigorous. There is a fantastic organization built up around it to enforce its rules, and there's great ethics involved. So it's a good organization, but for most of our listeners, it's for the most part, I think, inapplicable. If you have the CFA, it doesn't mean you know anything about financial planning at all. It doesn't go into financial planning. Then there's the CPA. So certified public accountant. And this is a great designation as well. One of the most difficult to achieve, probably right up there with the CFA. It's certainly more difficult than the CFP. But this is really more focused on accounting and maybe taxes and things like that. So for your, and you don't even necessarily need to have a CPA do your taxes, but knowing that your accountant or your the person doing your taxes has the CPA does give you, I think, some peace of mind and that they have the capabilities to do what they need to do. But CPAs also have a designation called a PFS. And it's escaping me what that stands for. I think it's personal financial specialist. And it's basically an add-on designation if you have the CFP that the coursework for the most part encompasses what the CFP does. So if you have a CPA who has the PFS, we are throwing around. I feel like we're in education right now. You know, if you're in education, there is an acronym for everything. There's probably an acronym for the word acronym. Same in this designation, this alphabet soup of designations. But the CPA PFS is also a very legitimate designation for someone to have. So I think they can have confidence in that. And I talked earlier about the CHFC, the Chartered Financial Counselor. This is not a designation I really push that much because it's usually taken by insurance agents. But the coursework is definitely equivalent and actually goes beyond the CFP. There's just not the same exam structure, the same society structure that the CFP has. I do think that at some point in time, people who have the CHFC should be given some sort of opportunity to let that be converted to a CFP if they wanted to. I don't know if that'll ever happen, but those are some of the legitimate designations that people should look for. AIF is another one, accredited investment fiduciary, but again, that's not as rigorous to get, and it doesn't really do much in the way of financial planning. So, for the minimum standard for financial planning, really should be the CFP. If someone doesn't have that, you just need to dig a little bit deeper if you think that they're the right person to work for. If someone or work with. If someone does have the CFP, that doesn't mean you're done with your homework yet. It's just a it's a good start.
And we're going to now talk about, the term fiduciary. We'll look at compensation. We'll go over some of the questions you're going to want to ask any potential advisor. And then we will also list some resources for finding competent advisors. So, Scott, what about the term fiduciary? And that's a big part of the CFP designation, right?
Well, it didn't used to be. There was some allusion to best interest, but the CFP board over the last decade, there's been some changes. And now, if you're a CFP, you are held to a fiduciary responsibility. We'd have to take a look at the language and compare it to the fiduciary responsibility that an investment advisor has. It might not be the exact same thing, but in essence, being a fiduciary is someone who is required to put the best interest of their clients ahead of their own, which is not a simple thing to do if you're in the business of selling products. So a fiduciary is just that, someone who puts your interest ahead of their own. And it gets a little more complicated, but you do want someone who is a fiduciary. I don't know why anyone, let's put it this way. I don't know why I would want to work with someone who's not committed to putting my best interest first. That makes no sense to me from a consumer standpoint.
Well, Scott, as you know, there is a pretty ferocious battle playing out right now in the regulatory space where folks like ourselves are advocating for the use of fiduciary for someone wanting to call themselves a planner. And there's been a lot of pushback on this. Do you want to just give a kind of a quick overview on what's going on in regards to this?
Yeah, the Department of Labor has come out with a set of regulations to regulate conflicts of interest within retirement plans. So we'll say ERISA retirement plans. This would be 401ks and certain healthcare plans of or certain 403b plans of nonprofits. So, oh, and also it would govern our IRA accounts, individual retirement accounts. And this is really the thing that is getting the I'll say the insurance industry, but the non-fiduciary industry up in arms, is these new fiduciary rules are going to apply to IRA accounts. So if you make a recommendation, if you're a quote unquote advisor and you make a recommendation in an IRA, and that recommendation is not in the best interest of your customer, you could be held responsible for that. And that is not a rule that's in place today. So the rule that's in place today is called the suitability standard, which just means it's like the minimum standard. Like this product just has to be demonstrated to not be terrible for you. You know, it doesn't even have to be good for you. It just can't be really bad for you, and then you can sell it to them. That standard's about to change, and that product has to be in the best interest of the customer. Otherwise, you could be held responsible. And someone who is a good resource for this is Ron Rhodes. His
How do you
all
spell that last name?
it's I think it's Rhodes.
Okay.
He is a prolific blogger. He is a professor as well, and I'm trying to see if I can find his website. I think it's scholarfp.blogspot.com, I think is his website. We'll maybe put it in the show notes. But he has just some amazing stuff on his website on the difference between the fiduciary and suitability and this whole fiduciary standard. Recently, he was on Barry Ritholt's podcast, Masters in Business. That was a great episode. I would highly recommend anybody who wants to learn about the fiduciary standard check that out. But yeah, fiduciary. But here's the thing, fiduciary is great. I think everybody who works. Any advisor, a person who calls himself an advisor who works with someone needs to be a fiduciary. But I think what consumers need to know is just because someone calls themselves a fiduciary doesn't mean that they know what they're doing. So it's not just being a fiduciary, it's being competent. And someone is breaching their fiduciary responsibility if they pretend to have competence in an area that they don't.
We'll go on to, I'll discuss the fiduciary pledge we have available on 403bys, and then we'll get into the different compensation structures. But Scott, wouldn't you say one of the big concerns, in the reason there's a need for the fiduciary designation for folks that work with IRA money is oftentimes people are retiring, they're rolling over 401k, 403b money, and they're rolling it over to an IRA, and then these individuals who don't have the fiduciary designation, they could then behave in a way that is not in the best interest of their clients. Is that part of it too?
Yeah, so what this new Department of Labor rule basically says, two things. One, the act of recommending that you roll money out of a defined contribution plan is a fiduciary act. So if you tell someone who has a 401k to roll that to an IRA, you're making a fiduciary recommendation. And when that money goes into the IRA, whatever it is that you sell to them is a fiduciary act. And that's a big deal because there are to accept commissions and to recommend products that are not in the best interest of the participant could be a prohibited transaction, which could be eventually could be criminal. So, I mean, it is a big deal, and the industry is taking it seriously and really pushing back on it because it's going to change how these people get paid, what they can recommend, how they do it. And what's really interesting, and I don't know if you've seen this lately, but Elizabeth Warren she's just totally trolling the industry lately, and it's just fantastic. You have the situation where the Department of Labor created a process where the industry could comment on this rule, and so there was 3 days of comments. I mean, there was actually an enormous number of written comments submitted, and then there was 3 days of testimony, and you can watch all of this testimony. And I know you don't have the time, but if you do have the time, watch some of it because it is unbelievable what some of these companies actually said out loud to a regulatory organization. I can't even believe it. Well, the exact things that they were saying to the Department of Labor, that it's going to destroy their business, that it's terrible, and it's going to cost all this money. Some of these companies are publicly traded, and on their earnings call, their quarterly earnings call with their shareholders, But take a step back. When you are a publicly traded company, you have to disclose all risks and you have to disclose all sorts of things to your shareholders. Otherwise, the SEC will come and prosecute you. So that means these companies had to talk about the risks related to the fiduciary rule. And you know what these companies said on their calls? The exact opposite of what they said to the Department of Labor. They were saying things like, it's not a problem. We're going to deal with this. We're going to be even better off than before. Things are going to be fine. They were telling their shareholders that they're going to get through this and still prosper, which is different than the Armageddon tone they took with the Department of Labor. So Elizabeth Warren took copies of all this stuff and put it into a letter to send off, and it was Elizabeth Warren being Elizabeth Warren. It was great.
God love her. Someday we will get her on the podcast, I am certain. All right, Scott, I'm going to mention four compensation models that I'm familiar with, and go ahead and give us your thoughts on these, and then share any others that maybe that aren't mentioned here, and then also maybe give a recommendation on probably what someone would the best model for most people. So I think the first one's kind of self-explanatory, commission-based. Do you want to talk about that? Well, how does that model work?
Well, commission-based, I mean, just as it sounds, you sell, your compensation is going to be based on selling a product. When it comes to investment management, it really makes no sense to use a commission-based advisor. I mean, if you're going to be buying, I'll take a step back. If you're actually maybe working with a Schwab or a Fidelity or TD Ameritrade or Scottrade, and you are placing your own trades for maybe exchange-traded funds, which are basically like mutual funds, or you're buying mutual funds, that's okay. They're acting as a broker and you're paying a commission for them to execute a trade for you, but you're paying like 8, 9, 10, 12 bucks for it. Not a big deal. That's commissions, those are fine. But when you're doing financial planning and you're buying financial products, paying commissions in general is a bad idea. Presents extreme conflicts of interest and provides an incentive to sell something when maybe something shouldn't have been sold at all. And it also introduces the idea that if they sell one product over another, they'll get paid more to sell that other product. And that's really what the Department of Labor rule is about, is getting rid of conflicts of interest. But commissions aren't always bad. I mean, if you're a real estate agent, you're going to be on commission. I don't really know a better business model at this point in time. And I work with some commission-based insurance agents who I think are competent, ethical, and just incredibly knowledgeable and experienced. So I don't sell insurance because it does entail receiving commissions, and I am a fee-only advisor. But guess what? It's incredibly important that you have insurance, certain types of insurance. And so I will help people create the framework for deciding what type of insurance they need and how much. And I'll refer them to a commission-based insurance broker. And only because I have vetted them do I refer them over to them, because I know they'll do the right thing. And believe it or not, commissions don't always cloud somebody's judgment. I don't think that the people I refer to are going to sell my clients something that is not in their best interest, because they want to continue to get business from me and from those clients. So in certain cases, I think commissions are okay. But when it comes to investment management, financial planning, there's really no reason to be paying commissions.
Okay, and the next model, fee plus commission.
So this is one that gets very confusing for people. And it's becoming confusing because a lot of brokerage firms and advisors, quote unquote advisors, are pushing it because they hear this fee-only term and people want to work with a fee-only advisor. And so they created this term called fee-based. And that's where this fee and commission model is. So someone who might manage accounts for a fee or charge a fee, they might also sell commission-based products, annuities, mutual funds, whatever. But you don't know, when they're doing things for a fee, they have to act as a fiduciary. But when they're selling products, they don't. The problem with that is you don't know when they're acting as a fiduciary and when they're not. And that's why asking the question, are you a fiduciary, isn't actually enough. It's, are you a fiduciary at all times? And that's the key, because a lot of these fee-based advisors are not actually fiduciaries. They're not fiduciaries all the time. And they might be able to sell you products that aren't in your best interest, are not fiduciary based, and they're trying to be something that they're not, because people love this term fee, so that they've co-opted fee only and used the term fee based. Fee based to me is a bit of a red flag.
Well, it almost makes me think that they're going to get some regulations requiring a fiduciary standard, and the industry is going to invent a term with the word fiduciary in it that is legally compliant but lets them behave the way they used to. I just can almost guarantee something like this is gonna happen.
We're fiduciary based.
Yeah.
We support the idea of fiduciary. We just aren't fiduciaries. Yeah, I'm sure there will be plenty of Orwellian doublespeak that will invade the industry.
Sigh. Okay, so two more compensation structures. Fee only. Scott, you mentioned that, I believe, a few moments earlier. You said you are a fee only planner.
I am a fee-only planner. So essentially what that means is all of my compensation comes directly from my clients in the form of fees. And those fees could be an asset-based fee, they could be an hourly fee, they could be a flat quarterly fee. Some advisors now, there's a network called the XY Planning Network, and I think it's an interesting organization to work with. They have some planners who work on like a monthly subscription-based fee, which is kind of a new model that I think is interesting. And then you have like the Garrett Planning Network. I think you're going to mention them later. They work, a lot of their advisors work on an hourly based fee. So they'll tell you about how many hours it'll take, or you'll sit down with them like you would an attorney or an accountant and pay them by the hour. They're not selling products to you. They're required to act as a fiduciary. They're required to act in your best interest. So their recommendations are driven not based on what product they can sell, because they don't make money selling products. Anything they recommend to you is because they think it's in your best interest. They're being compensated by you, so they're working for you.
Okay. And salary.
Oh, that's an interesting one. Typically, you'll see salary-based advisors at places like Schwab, TD, maybe at credit unions, perhaps within a retirement plan. I work with a lot of retirement plans where they have a salaried advisor who services that retirement plan and helps people enroll, helps people take distributions, helps people invest their money. This one is a little difficult because it really depends on the situation as to whether or not they're a fiduciary, whether or not they're going to work in your best interest. Typically, they're not going to, their compensation is not based on selling products. Sometimes they have a bonus structure with their salary, so it might be based on bringing in assets. You have to dig a little deeper. If you're working with a financial planning firm that has a staff of planners, and that's a fee-only planner firm, and their staff of planners are paid on a salary, that's okay. That's great. You want to look at the organization to see, are they fee only? Are they fiduciaries? And believe it or not all financial planners want to be in the business of getting out there and marketing and bringing in new clients. I know for me, that was the hardest part of starting my business. I had to, what they say, I had to go out and eat what I killed. I'm a salesperson. I am a salesperson. I have to go out and I have to market and I have to get clients in order to make a living. And some people are not great salespeople. And so they go to work for a company who has a staff of people that goes out and gets clients, and they service those clients. They're a salaried staff like you would see at a legal firm and another professional organization. You have to look at their credentials as well. But for the most part, if they're at a fee-only firm, and they're credentialed and they're competent and the firm has a good philosophy, then you should work with them, and they're going to probably be amazing. But there are salary people who might work for another organization, maybe a credit union or a bank, and I see this a lot, where they are just there to, they don't make money selling products, but they get their salary is there so that they can go and sell products to people. So you have to look at the organization of who that person is working for, what they believe in, whether or not they're fiduciaries, and whether how they get compensated to determine if that person should you should be working with.
Okay, good information. And we've talked about companies that we're fans of, TIAA-CREF, Fidelity, T. Rowe Price, Vanguard, USAA. I think credit unions can often be a good way to go. All right, Scott, how about the term robo-advisor?
This has become a very popular term in the industry. I'm not so sure it's really filtered down to mainstream people, but over the last, I'd say, 3 years, we've really seen the rise of these online-only companies that manage portfolios for people. And literally everything from the account opening process to the transferring of money into these accounts. It all takes place online. There's no paperwork. Excuse me, there's no paperwork. It's very simple to do, and everything is automated. Essentially, the investment management is done using an algorithm and exchange traded funds. So basically mutual funds, usually from Vanguard or sometimes BlackRock. It really depends. And it's commoditizing to a large extent the asset management business, because really all it's doing is just taking low cost index funds, layering on a very low cost. Some of these are charging only 0.25%. Schwab came out with one that doesn't charge anything. They make their money in a few different ways. We can talk about it on another call, another podcast. Vanguard has a robo advisor, if you will, and I think the jury is still out on the future of where these are going to go, but I don't think they're going away. And I think the asset management business is certainly getting commoditized, meaning that the costs are eventually going to get to be very low. And so an advisor who is just only offering investment advice and just asset allocation is going to find themselves with very few clients and losing clients to these robo advisors. So an advisor, if they want to survive, has to add value in other ways than just asset allocation.
Well, that's a perfect segue because we maybe should have addressed this question at the very top. Why would you even want to work with an advisor? And what does a, let's say planner, what does a planner do?
Well, those are great questions. I get that a lot. First of all, there is a great piece on Michael Kitsis's website, which is kitsis.com. So that's KITCES.com. I'll have to see if I can find the link. Maybe we can put it in the show notes. But it's a great piece on advisors versus salespeople. So everybody calls themselves an advisor, and most of them are not. And so it really gets into what is an advisor versus a salesperson. At the end of the day, an advisor is someone who, for a fee, will make recommendations for you, whereas a salesperson is someone who is, all their income comes from selling products. And we need to get away from this idea that if you're someone who's selling financial products, that you're an advisor. You're not. The reason someone would want to work with a true advisor is because they lack expertise in a financial field that this advisor is good at and understands. So, for example, I'm a financial planner. I told you I had a degree in finance. I'm a certified financial planner, and I have a master's degree in financial planning. And I do a lot of work to keep up in the financial planning field. So when someone comes to me, they're not just coming to me for investment advice. They're not just saying, here, I want you to, manage my portfolio and let's talk once a year and let's make a few changes once a year. That's fine if that's what you want, but a true advisor is going to look at your entire life situation. They're going to evaluate your life insurance or your insurance needs. They're going to evaluate your retirement needs, your college planning needs, what to do with your properties. all of the different life and financial decisions you have to make, you can bounce those decisions off of that advisor, and hopefully they can use good financial planning software, maybe some spreadsheets, to demonstrate what path you're on and how your different decisions will affect you going forward. And hopefully they can also get you to a point where you have taken a lot of the risks that you face and hopefully diminished them. Those are some of the things that you might go to a financial advisor for.
I like to think in metaphors and maybe the idea of a jigsaw puzzle. You have a lot of puzzle pieces in your life, saving for college, saving for retirement, insurance, emergency money, a home, investment property, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I know that you look at the totality of a person's financial picture and make recommendations based on that.
That's right. And I always say financial planning is an ongoing process. I was working with a client the other day, and we're projecting numbers out 30 years from now, which is like the one thing I can tell you is that these projections are going to be wrong. They just are. You can't project 30 years out. But the idea is that let's make these projections and see where they're taking us if you stay on this path. And then let's see if we make certain changes, how that might affect that path going forward. And then every year, every 2 years, or periodically, let's check in to see how the progress that we've made towards those goals has been, and whether or not we need to make changes along the way. Financial planning is not a one-time thing. It's a long-term process.
And I think that's one of our biggest frustrations with these people who troll school cafeterias, school lounges. They are commission-based salespeople that sign teachers up. And my understanding is they're doing this at the higher ed level, and they're also doing it in the healthcare field. And they sign these people up, and they might not see them again 5, 10 years. And they're still getting commission every single time a transaction occurs.
And there are bad salespeople in every profession. I think there are a lot of those people in this industry, and that's why sometimes when I start working with a new teacher, they'll have like 6 or 7 contracts because there'll be a new person that's in there every year, and so they get put into something new. And the incentives that are in some of these products also drive the behavior of some of these salespeople as well. And so that's an issue. But there are some good ones out there. I know that there are, and I hate to say this, but it is true. There are some people who work on a commission and who work with teachers, and they actually know the systems. They understand the retirement system. They understand a lot of financial planning issues that surround these teachers, and they do good work for them. But they're kind of the exception, and they're really working out of a strange regulatory structure because they're not regulated as financial planners, and so it's kind of weird. But I think you're going to probably do better avoiding the commission-based people selling annuities in your lunchroom. You're going to do better by avoiding them.
Well, I think this is another good segue into our next section. We're going to talk about questions to ask an advisor, and then we'll talk about where to find an advisor. And Scott, I think we can wrap this up in about 5 minutes and actually get done inside an hour, which is probably good for our audience. So as I alluded to, we have something that Scott has helped me put together called the 403B Wise Advisor Questionnaire. It's a series of 20 questions. It's available from the 403B Wise homepage. And two of the questions include, will I work directly with you? And how often will we meet? Because again, a lot of times there's these sort of, what would you call it, a one-day stand, Scott, instead of a one-night stand?
A one-lunch stand.
A one-lunch stand, that's right. Oh my gosh. So I'm not going to read all 20 questions because it's very easily accessible, but some of the, just kind of an overview, you're asking them about their educational background and financial credentials. You're asking them their investing philosophy, and you're asking them to explain how they will diversify your investments. You're also asking how they're compensated, and as I mentioned earlier, how often you'll meet. And we also have a link to our fiduciary pledge. And I think you would be wise to get any person that you're going to work with to sign this fiduciary pledge. Anything, Scott, generally on the type of questions? And again, you helped me craft this pretty extensive list.
Well, I would, on the fiduciary question, if they work for a broker-dealer or a brokerage firm, or even if they're an insurance agent, I would get their immediate superior to sign it as well. Because my experience is that sometimes brokers will sign just about anything to make a sale. And if the broker-dealer, if that document has to go through compliance, guarantee you the broker dealer's compliance department will not sign that document, and they will you will I mean they'll be happy that you sent it to them because you probably kept them out of a lawsuit, but they will not sign it. Most brokers who work for broker dealers, the big brokerage firms, are legally or by policy prohibited from acting as fiduciaries.
God, I'd love to see a hidden camera situation where someone's taking our fiduciary pledge to these groups and individuals who may not sign it. Okay, so I guess the last thing I would say is where to find an advisor. And we are huge fans of the Garrett Planning Network, which was started by Cheryl Garrett, who was our first celebrity guest, I would say, Scott. We had her on episode 15. So if you'd like to listen to that, please reference episode 15. Scott, would you add anything? Oh, before I throw it back to you, a little sort of foreshadowing and preview. As we've discussed, Scott, my wife and I are, who's a web designer, very talented. We are in the midst of a major redesign of 403BYs, and I feel confident enough to give a little bit of a preview here. We are going to expand our focus beyond K-12, and we're going to have sections on specifically designated for higher education and the healthcare market. And we are also going to increase advisor participation within 403BYs. And we want to get a lot more of these individuals visible on our site. I don't want to give details on what that'll look like just yet, but we're hopeful that we will have a listing of advisors who are in tune with our philosophy.
Yeah, no, I'm excited about that. The expansion, I think, is a great idea. I think this website has been so impactful in the K-12 market and even the higher ed market as it's been. And I think a lot of healthcare people come to the website anyways. But I think it would be nice for them to have more specifics geared toward them because the healthcare market is very different than the K-12. A lot of those plans are ERISA, and they're kind of governed by slightly different rules. Higher ed market doesn't tend to need as much of the advocacy as is required in K-12. They might have three providers. They might have a multiple provider system that's TIAA, CREF, Fidelity, and Vanguard. And I'm not going to really shed any tears. That's awesome. They don't need the advocacy. So they have little different sets of needs, and I'm hoping that we can fill those.
And I can
And I
say,
can say
as
as
someone,
someone
ooh, get a little bit of
I
feedback here. I can say,
can
as
say
someone
so.
who teaches at the university level right now, there's a lot of misunderstanding and lack of understanding in the retirement plan options with my colleagues. And they have big, at least at my university, University of New Mexico, they have new hire fairs. And I didn't go to it just because I feel like I have some understanding of this stuff, and obviously I have you to help me, but I'm not certain that these folks are educated enough and have the information. So we're hoping we can be another resource. So Scott, I think we're going to get in under an hour here, probably because we had no beer. We probably sound really boring today since we didn't even have any drinks.
Well, I had plenty of coffee. I don't know if that helps, but yeah, I think we're gonna get in. Let me throw in real quick. In addition to Garrett Planning Network, you should go to NAPFA.org, and we're gonna put this in the show notes. At least Dan will, because he's the guy who does all this stuff. NAPFA.org, NAPFA.org. The CFP board, so CFP.net, I think is the term. You can look for advisors there. And I mentioned earlier, the XYPN network is something you should check out as well. I think those, and by the way, none of these entities have advertised with us. We're not mentioning them because they are paying us, but we would love for them to pay us and advertise.
True, true, true. Yeah,
Just
call us.
call me.
That's right. All right, Scott. So we've got about 20 seconds here to get in, inside the hour threshold. Always enjoy speaking with you. Thanks for the great information. I really think this is going to be useful.
You bet, Dan. It's been a great podcast. Thanks.
See ya. Music you hear on the Teach and Retire Rich podcast was provided by Moreland and Arbuckle. You can check them out at morelandarbuckle.com.